The Cycling Podcast, in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freiba.
Hello, Richard.
English pronunciation for the fact because we're in the UK.
We are.
A rare appearance. And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
A rare appearance from Lionel as well. When's the last time the three of us were all together?
That is a very good question. It would have been at the tour, no?
Pre-Vuelta, certainly.
Yeah.
It's been a while, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Feels good, though, doesn't it?
Oh, it feels magnificent.
the enthusiasm exuding from Daniel is, I mean, it's probably coming through the airwaves to the listeners.
It's quite nice because I had a week with Orla in Innsbruck, so the contrast is nice, you know. It's really good.
Not enthusiastic.
It's rebalancing.
Just very focused. There's so much to process. So much has happened in the last few weeks.
It certainly has.
The podcast derby, we had that. The World Championships. You know, you've had a major life event.
I have had a major life event. Yeah, you're right.
Congratulations, yeah. Lionel.
Thank you very much,
from
Richard.
From everybody.
Thank you.
I speak for everybody involved with the cycling podcast.
Should probably explain what has actually happened. Yeah, fatherhood. Yeah,
little girl.
Indeed.
Doing well?
Yeah, very well. Everyone's doing well now. It was slightly traumatic for a few days, but all fine now. I'm
he
really
started blogging again.
He was blogging. He was rattling them off like there was no tomorrow a couple of days ago.
It's interesting. You find that there's suddenly a lot of time where you can't do anything other than look
blog.
After a baby or blog. Yeah. So I'm making use of that time.
Impressive.
I'm also a lot more awake than I've ever been. Spending a lot of time awake.
What about the partridge that was trapped in your back alley? Is that, or was it a peacock?
Phyllis.
Any relation to Pozzato?
Phyllis, the partridge, has properly moved in. She's basically making herself at home with our two chickens in the back garden, eating their food. Generally, has decided to become a semi-domesticated pheasant. Amazing.
I said these arrivals, well, things happen in threes, don't they? You've had two arrivals there, and a third one must be imminent.
What could it be?
Well, listen, there's lots of cycling to pack in here. We've got an interview with Peter Sagan in the final part, a bit of an extended conversation with Peter Sagan. His book has just come out, and I met him in Soho last week, so we'll hear from him. I thought he was quite interesting. You know, we're so used to hearing him in the mix zone at the Tour de France or at races, speaking in short kind of sound bites. It was quite interesting to get him talking at length on a few things. So we'll hear from him in part three. And there's been a lot of races, obviously. We'll hear what you think about the World Championships and Valverde's win there in particular. And there's been some more recent racing as well. But Lionel, have you got a news roundup?
I have, yeah. There's been a lot of racing as the season kind of comes to its conclusion, the road season, that is. At the weekend, it was Paris-Tours, and we'll talk a little bit about that, the French. What is it now? Is it still a classic or a semi-classic? It's been kind of downgraded in recent years, really.
We're fairly old school, aren't we? We always consider it to be a classic, a bona fide classic. We always lament the fact that it's not considered a monument, but its status has really dwindled in the last few years, hasn't it?
It has, because it's not in the World Tour, of course. And this year they've introduced some gravel sections, which has a split opinion. Patrick Lefebvre, very anti the gravel sections. He's the Quickstep boss, and he's actually said that Quickstep won't take part in future years if they keep the gravel in the race. I mean, it's traditionally been a sprinter's classic. We'll probably talk a little bit about this, but it was won by Søren Krogh Andersen of Team Sunweb. He was second last year to Matteo Trentin. He went one better this time, ahead of Nicky Terpstra, and Benoit Cousin-Effroy was the third rider on the podium. That was the kind of the biggest race in this post-World Championship period, but there's been a lot of other racing across Europe. There was the Chimay-Binch one-day race, the Frank Vandenbroek Memorial Race, which was won by Danny van Poppel of Lotto Jumbo. The Munsterland Giro in Germany was a real German fest, Daniel. Top five were all German riders. Max Walscheid, the promising young sprinter, beat John Degenkolb there.
Meanwhile, some fantastic R&B playing. Fantastic Mariah Carey. Mariah Carey's link with professional cycling? Give me one link between Mariah Carey and professional cycling.
Did she win the Alfredo Binder Trophy?
She wore a Vitalicio Segura cycling cap in a terrible movie called Glitter. Wow. At the end of the 90s. Anyway,
that rings a bell.
Resume, Lionel.
Should probably have said, yeah, we're in the downstairs cafe at the Curzon Cinema in London, Soho, so that's why there's music playing in the background. Muzak. That's coming through. The Italian time trial championships were also held because I think there was problems securing the course, closing the roads in the traditional national championship slot in June. Nevertheless, Gianni Moscon won for a second year in a row, just 2 seconds ahead of Filippo Ganna. Couple of races in France. Paris-Bourges was won by Valentin Madouas, the son of former professional Laurent Madouas. The Tour de Vendée was won by Nico Denz of AG2R. And in Italy, we had the Giro dell'Emilia, a real strong top 10 there. Alessandro De Marchi of BMC Racing won ahead of Rigoberto Urán, Dylan Teuns, Michael Woods, Thibaut Pinot, Romain Bardet, Primoz Roglic and Vincenzo Nibali, and that really gives us an indication of what might happen at Il Lombardia at the weekend. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. Bauke Mollema won the Grand Prix Beghelli, another Italian one-day race. Off the bike and away from the racing, it's been announced that the 2022 UCI World Road Championships will be in Wollongong in Australia. That'll be the second time Australia has hosted the Road Worlds. A bit of transfer news. Mark Cavendish looks set to stay with Dimension Data. Daniel will probably have a bit of intel on that in a bit. Dimension Data have lost Mahawi Kudus, the young Eritrean climber, though. He's going to Astana. Egan Bernal has signed a bumper five-year contract with Team Sky. And Quickstep, well, we're waiting for an announcement, which could happen while we're recording. So if it does happen while we're recording, we'll update later on. We'll have some breaking news in the podcast. But Quickstep are looking to secure sponsorship for next year. It had been rumoured that they might lose Fernando Gaviria with UAE Team Emirates, looking most likely to pick him up. But it doesn't now look like they will lose their Colombian sprinter. And some very sad news to finish up with. Jimmy Duquesnoy, a young Belgian rider, 23 years of age, rode for the WB Aqua Protect Veren Classic team, has died of a cardiac arrest, age 23. One of a number of deaths of young Belgian riders in the last couple of years. You may remember Michael Goulart's died after a cardiac arrest during Paris-Roubaix earlier this year. So another very sad event there.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Shortly after we finished recording this week's episode, it was confirmed that Patrick Lefebvre's Quickstep team has a new title sponsor for the 2019 season. And it's not so much a tongue twister, but we wanted to make sure we didn't fall foul of the pronunciation police on day one. So we got in touch with Chief Inspector Rob Hatch for the definitive pronunciation of Quickstep's new title sponsor.
De Koning. De Koning. De Koning.
Thank you very much indeed to RAFA, our headline sponsor. Bit of RAFA news this week as well. They are returning to the World Tour next year with EF Education First. Not just supplying the kit, but it's a content partnership as well. So they're going to be producing films and other media content about the riders, the team, and the races. So that'll be interesting to watch. And something in the press release that I thought was intriguing was that the riders will... there'll be an alternative calendar for some of the riders. So as well as all the standard road events, they're going to be dabbling in sort of slightly different events. We're thinking Red Hook Criteriums, maybe Transcontinental Race, mountain bike races, who knows? But this is a very interesting development, and we'll watch that with great interest. I'm doing a bike ride tomorrow as well, chaps.
Wow.
Why?
With the CEO and founder of RAFA, Simon Mottram, and a few of his friends.
How far is it?
You know perfectly well, Lionel. And that's why I've just literally started shaking.
It's 100 miles. It's 100 English miles. Daniel, that's about 160 kilometres for our continental friends.
Okay. Oh, that sounds even worse. I thought I could do 100 miles, but I'm not sure I can do 160 kilometres.
No, the big difference. Big difference.
I'm very nervous about this. It's a long time since I've ridden this distance, and I'm not sure I'll do it tomorrow.
Is there team car support?
Well, I established that there is, yeah. That,
I think you'll be fine then.
Oh, I'm very nervous about it, but I'll report back next week if I'm able to.
Yeah, I rode not far off 100 miles with Ned Bolting in June with Simon Gill, Simon the photographer, for a forthcoming series, a spin-off series of the cycling podcast. Can't say too much about that at the moment, really, can we?
No.
No.
top secret lineup.
Probably shouldn't have even mentioned it here, should I?
No, that's fine. Don't worry.
But it's a considerable. Yeah, if you've not ridden that distance for a while, it's a considerable undertaking, Richard. Is it hilly?
I think it's rolling.
Rolling.
Rolling is just a euphemism for hilly, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm not.
So who shall we get to do the podcast next week in your absence?
Oh, dear. Anyway, let's not dwell on that. Let's talk about some of the racing. Well, Paris-Tours, I watched quite a lot of it. Good race, beautiful race. Surprising to see Patrick Lefebvre come out so strongly against the roads, the gravel, the dirt roads of the vineyards. They look beautiful, and they're not exactly strangers in Belgium to, you know, bad road surfaces.
I mean, for a guy who's based his reputation, his career almost as a direct sportif on success, particularly in two races, the Tour of France and Paris-Roubaix, to suggest that the surfaces of those vineyard tracks that the Paris Tour route covered yesterday were inadequate for road riding, I thought was a little bit rich. No?
Yeah, I think this is strange, really. I mean, Paris Tour, it's had, of all of the one-day classics, really, it's had the sort of... it's had a very changeable past, hasn't it? I mean, it's not been called Paris Tour. It used to be called the Grand Prix de l'Automne, the Grand Prix of the Autumn. It's run from the outskirts of Paris to down towards the Tour area, but also it's run in the opposite direction in part of its life as a one-day race. And it's traditionally been very favourable for sprinters, but in recent years they put in these little climbs on the approach to Tour to change the character of the race, to shake it up a little bit. And I think it really, to use a phrase that's appropriate for the vineyards that it goes through, because obviously it's a big wine region, the Loire Valley, isn't it? It was withering on the vine, Paris Tour, and it's the sort of race that if ASO hadn't...
Sour grapes from Lefebvre. It can't be sour grapes because he said it before the race was actually over.
But if ASO didn't own it, it would not exist, Paris Tour. The fact it's not in the World Tour, again, if ASO didn't own it, it would have just disappeared. And if somebody had sprung up with a new race from the Paris area, Chartres, which, I mean, is just outside Paris, and said, we're going to run a race through the beautiful-looking Loire Valley at the start of autumn, and we're going to take it off-road, Strada Bianchi style, and have some gravel sections. Everyone would be saying, wow, this is fantastic. What a breath of fresh air. And this is the way things are going. And, Richard, you mentioned there EF Education First potentially dipping into different types of cycling.
That, doesn't it?
This is the way the wind is blowing, and I think cycling, you know, it will go with the prevailing wind, and then when this kind of falls out of favour and falls out of fashion again, then they maybe Paris Tours will become a full-on 50-up bunch sprint type race again in future when that's back in vogue. I mean, this is, you know, it's just evolution, and
I think it looked absolutely sensational, and you know, we talked before about the kind of demographic that's become interested in cycling recently, and the fact that you know, it visited a very beautiful part of the Loire Valley, the vineyards of Vouvray, and you know, a lot of people watching will have had their eyes open to that part of France, and that is one of the purposes that cycle racing has to serve now. And you know, it's a rare example in the cycling industry, in professional cycling, of joined up thinking, of responding to a trend in the market. I think maybe 9 gravel sections was a bit too many, and some of them were perhaps not in good enough condition, and there was a bit too much luck involved. But again, as we've said before, you know, in an age when we're bombarded with social media messages about you know, each team's equipment supplier and what a huge effect that has, whether it be aerodynamics or clothing or whatever, equipment and the ability to choose the right equipment for a particular type of course, that is something that feeds into the race. You know, I mean, teams and riders can use wider tires with sealant in the tire, which might slow them down slightly, their equipment choices, but then they're insuring themselves against punctures, and probably some teams yesterday at Paris Tour got that slightly wrong, and it's a risk reward, and I think that's a fascinating dimension to this kind of race, and you know, something that would interest the watching public, you know, if they knew more about the kind of equipment choices being made by teams. So I thought, I mean, sort of thumbs up from me, I would say.
And that this, you know, going off road, it taps into that sense of the bike as a tool for adventure, doesn't it? Which I think is very appealing to a lot of people, especially now with roads being so congested and so on, seeking off-road, but not necessarily on a mountain bike, on a road bike. I think that's a great thing. And if racers can connect themselves to that world, they will make themselves relevant. And again, I think you're right, Lionel. I think it does tie into this announcement from EF Education First that they're going to look for other alternative things to do as well as just the standard world tour calendar.
Yeah, and I think that the criticism that luck played too much of a part and that key riders had punctures, I mean, luck plays a part in every single bike race, even if it's an absolute dead-eyed sprint finish. Luck still plays a part. You get caught on the wrong wheel, somebody has a problem in front of you, you're too close to the curb, you're in the wind, whatever it happens to be. I think the trend within professional cycling for always wanting the strongest rider to yeah. win every single event, I mean, if we're going to go down that road, we're heading for a pretty tedious future, because otherwise we could just have a static bike test to find out who the strongest is. I mean, look at the Tour de France. How many people had bad luck this year? I mean, just off the top of my head, Richie Port crashed out at the wrong time. Luck plays a huge part in all bike races. And so, you know, if you have a puncture, you know, nobody really complains about luck at Paris-Roubaix. And in fact, the kind of the myth that we've allowed to grow up and the lie that everyone tells themselves is that the strongest rider wins Paris-Roubaix. That's actually not the case. It's the combination of the strongest rider with the best luck or the least bad luck.
And how many times over the last few years have we spent 10 minutes discussing Paris-Tour the day after Paris-Tour? I mean, it was an ailing race. It's a race that, you know, we might hold in a certain esteem and we might get nostalgic about, but the riders and the teams don't feel that way about it anymore, and it needed a new lease of life. And I think ASO have done well to act pretty quickly on this and almost be ahead of the curve with this. It was a race that they could easily have let sort of fester and die on the vine, as Lionel said, and they've tried to be proactive and they've done something pretty innovative, and I think they deserve credit for that.
And a good winner, Søren Krogh Andersen, very strong rider. He's had a really good year, and he won it extremely well. Slightly odd tactics from Nicky Terpstra behind, but he didn't seem very happy generally. Yeah. His last race for Quickstep as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, indeed. Just on the kind of the innovation and races having a different feel, I mean, Paris-Tour, I've just had to look this up, but it rang a bell. In the mid-60s, they banned derailleur gears, and riders had to have just two, they could choose two gears, so they couldn't use a whole range of gears. And I think, again, you know, looking, how long will it be before there's a single gear one-day race? Somebody will hold one somewhere. You know, you mentioned the Red Hook crit there. I'm not saying fixed gears, because that would be chaos.
Did Daniel Oss ride the Red Hook crit in Milan? I think he did.
So yeah, I think, you know, there's room for all of this kind of innovation and difference, and if every race has a different kind of feel, then the calendar as a whole kind of develops a sense of rhythm.
Yeah,
to
coherence.
It.
I mean, just on that notion of joined up thinking, one slight regret maybe about a course like Paris-Tour yesterday is that, you know, with this increasing move towards gravel races, or the, you know, more and more of them popping up in the calendar, it's almost a shame that there can't be a gravel season where, you know, 2 or 3 weeks where we have the Trobriand, the GP Herning in Denmark,
yeah,
Paris-Roubaix, and
that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, Trobriand, yeah. The Great War Remembrance Race as well goes off road. There's something.
Gent-Wevelgem
Gent-Wevelgem. Yeah, no one said, oh, Gent-Wevelgem shouldn't go on the plug streets because it's, you know, it's not in keeping with the notion of the spring classics. So I think, yeah, fair play to them. It gives it a new lease of life.
And we're in the midst of the Italian races as well. Daniel, it's always, they're really great races to watch. Beautiful,
yeah,
part of the world. And it's just strange that there are so many of these races. And it always strikes me when I watch them and I see the infrastructure and I see the people working there, the effort that goes into putting on a race. Why are these races at this time of the year?
Well, you talk about a sort of coherent narrative and a portion of the calendar that makes sense. I think we mentioned last year that this is partly more by luck than judgment, but these races have now been grouped together. I mean, the Giro dell'Emilia was a race that was dying. It looked as though it was absolutely certain to die at one point. And partly by virtue of, it's a different race organizer to the to the Tour of Lombardy and Gran Piemonte, but partly by the virtue of RCS, so the Giro organizer, trying to group the three races that we've got this week together, and then the Trevalli Varesine, which is another different organizer. But I don't know to what extent there was a dialogue between them, but we've now got a block of the calendar which really has a very solid identity, a certain type of rider that is thriving those types of races. And Emilia at the weekend had the best field I think it's ever had. All of the sort of stars who were contending for the World Championships a week ago, the Pinos, the Bardets, the Miguel Angel Lopez's, and it's going to be a good week of racing.
Am I right in thinking that some of these races, like Trevalli Varesine, used to be the sort of the world selection races. So they used to be into the August time. And now they've all moved a bit later. And it's the likes of Milano Torino and the Giro del Piemonte that we lead up to Il Lombardo, or the Tour of Lombardy as we used to know it. This is another aspect of the season evolving to kind of meet a need, really. I mean, it must be good for the teams. They can base themselves all in one region one country and not do too much travelling. And then, you know, Il Lombardo, which is, I think, probably... that was another one that became a little bit after the Lord Mayor's show, didn't it? It used to just be, I mean, the late 90s and early 2000s, it felt to me like the new world champion would turn up and either, you know, just do enough to have some pictures taken of them in the new rainbow jersey. But Il Lombardo has really been keenly contested in recent years, and it's back to the level of being a bona fide monument again.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
The intervention of Seb Piquet, the voice of race radio at the Tour de France, of course, reminds me to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by ShipStation. ShipStation is America's number one e-commerce shipping software, and for the first time it's available in the UK. Now, Lionel, you're a man of the world, you sell books online, so I imagine this will be of interest to you.
That's right, Rich, I do. I know it's hard to believe I've got time for other enterprises considering my commitment to the cycling podcast, but I do also run a small publishing company. We do books on cycling and football, and so I'm often online shopping around for the best deals with courier firms when I've got books to send out. And at this time of the year, with Christmas coming, it can be quite time consuming weighing up all the different options. Sometimes I want to ship one book to an individual customer, and sometimes I want to send multiple boxes of books, quite a large consignment, to a wholesaler or retailer. And so finding the cheapest price and the best service can take a lot of time. I've lost hours going from website to website trying to figure out which is the best service for my particular job. And so I think that's what appeals to me most about ShipStation, because basically it's a service comparison website, so you can choose the right courier for the job. They offer all the major couriers, including Royal Mail, Hermes, Amazon Fulfillment, DHL, FedEx and UPS and more, and you can very easily see which is the best one for your particular consignment. So if you sell on eBay or Amazon, or even from your own web store as I do, you can connect it all up to ShipStation, so you can book the delivery, print off the labels and let somebody else do the hard work with the minimum of fuss. And that's the best thing about it for me. It's saved a lot of time going through all the different websites. You don't have to register for them all and remember all the login details. You can just go to one place, ShipStation, and do it all from there.
If you sell anything online, you can try ShipStation for free for 30 days and get a special bonus when you use the promotion code CYCLING. To take advantage of this incredible offer, just visit ShipStation.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in CYCLING. That's ShipStation.com, then enter the promotion code CYCLING. ShipStation.com. Get ship done. Well, we were talking about Il Lombardia before the break there, the Tour of Lombardy. Ciro, in our World Championship podcast, Ciro Scognamiglio tipped Vincenzo Nibali, thought Nibali would be better for that than he was at the World Championship. No real sign of returning form for Nibali thus far. One outsider, I would say, rode very well at Lombardy last year, Egan Bernal, who's returned to racing with a new set of teeth and a slightly reshaped nose after his crash in San Sebastian. He looks to be in pretty good shape, and you know, having had that time off, maybe he'll be fresh. Bauke Mollema looks good as well. Quite a few contenders. Who are you thinking?
Well, I think Lombardy traditionally was one of the harder, certainly one of the hardest classics on the calendar. You generally get climbers coming to the fore. And this year, the course isn't quite as hard as last year because the San Fermo della Battaglia, which was the last climb before the race reached Como, has been taken out because of problems with the road surface. Not surprising, we've talked earlier in the year, haven't we, about the diabolical state of Italian roads. But they've not been able to get that right in time for Lombardy. So it's a slightly easier course. But if you remember last year, Nibali had gone away before the San Fermo della Battaglia and sort of stayed away. So the course is hard enough in and of itself without that climb. I think Pino will go well. He's very motivated. I think I thought it was a bit of a shame last week at the World Championships that his work was done at the bottom of the final climb. I mean, he gave... he did a massive effort at the bottom of the final climb, which sort of blew him away, but I thought he was at least as strong as Roman Bardet. So Bardet, Pino both got a good chance. Nibali didn't convince me terribly at the Giro dell'Emilia. He's clearly getting better, and Lombardy is a long race where Diesel, like him, should be pretty good, but... My bet, Rich, would be, I would say Pino again. But, you know, I tip Pino for every race now.
On Pino, Orla did an interview with Pino at the World Championships, which we might play next week if he rides well in Lombardy. There's an incentive for you, Thibaut. But he did say the Strava art that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where he seemed to draw a goat with horns and everything. He said it was a total coincidence. He said that it was a complete accident. You calling foul on that, like, Daniel?
Not foul. I mean, a goat is not a bird.
No. He was trying to draw partridge. No, he was. He said it was a complete coincidence. He was initially kind of baffled by the question. They said, "Oh no, it was a total coincidence. It wasn't planned at all."
Yeah, even big coincidence when as I discussed in a previous podcast, he's someone who with an affinity
for goats.
Yeah, with a well-established affinity for goats, owns several of them.
Just on Il Lombardia, before we move on, I think EF Education first with Michael Woods, obviously banging form, great ride at the World Championships, possibly not a sprint to really talk of. Rigoberto Urán, the pair of them were in the top four at the Giro dell'Emilia, and if they can work in tandem, why not?
On the World Championships, you say not a sprint to talk of, and we'll talk about the World Championships in a moment because we'll see Valverde in his rainbow jersey as well, of course. Looking back at the World Championships, it was actually quite a surprisingly close sprint, I thought, between those three. You would look at that and go, Valverde's a clear winner there. But actually, it was close. I mean, Bardet especially pushed.
Yeah, I think it would have been even closer if Woods, because Woods had cramp in the last 400-500 metres, and he is quite an explosive rider. So, you know, it was, well, he was thrilled, wasn't he, with his medal. But I think he could have posed Valverde some major problems if he hadn't had those cramps.
The Worlds. Shall we turn our thoughts back to the Worlds? And, you know, we were obviously over there in Innsbruck and reported from the day, and didn't maybe reflect too much on Valverde as the winner with all the baggage that comes with Valverde. I mean, that's been something that people have been discussing. Like, we did an event at the Wimbledon Book Festival on Friday, Lionel. We were asked about this. You explained very well, I think, the difficulty when in responding to a Valverde win in a race like this.
Yeah, I mean, this is not sitting on the fence, but I can definitely see both sides. On the one hand, we have a justice system in cycling and in the world at large, where if somebody has served their suspension, then they can come back. I mean, Richard, you referenced David Miller's blog on his website about how he felt happy for Valverde and happy that Valverde had won, or certainly didn't have any misgivings about Valverde winning. I mean, my point is, I think it's okay to have reservations about Valverde winning. It's perfectly fine, particularly for fans. I mean, you can choose who you like and who you dislike based on a whole range of factors. It may be that you don't like the way somebody sits on a bike, or you don't like their tactics, or anything. So if somebody served a suspension for doping and you don't like that, you're perfectly at liberty not to support Alejandro Valverde. As a journalist, it's trickier to nail your colours so firmly to the mast. We try to be as even-handed as we possibly can. And I know people get irritated when every time we mention Valverde, I always say, well, and he had his 2-year suspension for a doping offence. I think the thing about Valverde is that had he been able to get away with it, he absolutely would have done, because it took quite an effort, a jigsaw of identification to nail Valverde to that particular blood bag. It was the 2008 Tour de France, which went across the border into Italy, and the Italian authorities chose to target test him and pair the DNA of the blood to his sample, and that's what led to his suspension for 2 years as part of the whole Operation Puerto blood doping ring that was run out of Madrid. So he served his suspension and came back to racing with the same team, so effectively suffered no penalty in that sense, and returned to a very high level of racing. And people obviously say, well, he was very good before when he was doping, and he's just as good afterwards. Now, you know, we can all debate whether or not the peloton has cleaned up incrementally in those years. So, I mean, that doesn't necessarily raise a red flag for me that he's still able to compete at that level at the age he is. But I think it's perfectly acceptable if you want to say I don't like the fact Valverde is the world champion and he's going to be wearing the rainbow bands for the next year. That's a perfectly valid position to take up.
It's funny, isn't it? I guess it's been so long. You know, Valverde's been around so long, and that doping suspension is now so long ago that we've got so used to Valverde winning that it can seem ridiculous in a way to caveat every Valverde success with this qualification that he served a doping ban. So over time, that you mentioned that less and less frequently, and so it's almost as if we begin to gloss over it a little bit. That's just the perception.
That's a cross that he has to bear by virtue of not having ever really worked actively on his rehabilitation and redemption. He's not particularly willing to talk about it. And when he did at the time receive his sanction, and when his legal team did appeal against the sanction, it was all an appeal. The appeal was based solely on procedural issues. It wasn't, the actual allegation wasn't really contested. As Lionel says, I think everyone's at liberty to feel the way they want to feel about it. And as I think I wrote on Twitter last week, one of the punishments for what he committed was that people now don't know how to feel about his successes, and they can't react with the same unbridled, undiluted, you know, admiration that they would otherwise have done, because if you look at his results and if you look at his longevity, I mean, it's a palmarès that really is up there with the greats in terms of consistency. I mean, that perhaps haven't been the variety of one-day wins or Grand Tour wins, indeed, that you would like to see or that you see in some of the absolute stars of the history of the sport. But, difficult to know how to feel as well in a context, in a climate, which we've mentioned many times recently, is difficult to read. It's difficult to know whether someone who doped in 2006 or 2005 could be riding at the same level now, with similar, not just the same results, but similar, you know, gross performances, watts and times on climbs. And, you know, Valverde, as I said, he's never really addressed the scandal, never really spoken about it openly, but a slight caveat to that, I would say, is that he's ridden in a context in Spain and in a Spanish team and with the Spanish media that has not really put him on the spot and demanded that he do that. I don't think he's particularly aware of the English-speaking media, the English-speaking social media, which is where a lot of the calls for him to justify what happened and to explain what happened and to explain what's different now come from.
Yeah, it is a case of geography, isn't it? I mean, at our event on Friday, Rich, you made the point that David Miller wouldn't have been able to come back as a rider had he not apologised, had he not really... there was a time where it was almost sort of self-flagellating, the extent to which Miller had to make amends for what he'd done, and he's done an awful lot of good. I mean, and yet he's still not universally popular. People will still hold his past against him, and again, that's perfect. People are perfectly entitled to do that. You're perfectly entitled not to like David Miller because of his doping, and you're perfectly entitled to think, well, just because he's now apologised, that's not enough for me. That's valid. But Valverde kind of does glide along the top, you know, almost almost oblivious to the way he is perceived outside of Spain, and that is a consequence of a different kind of, I don't want to say moral code, because that sounds really kind of high and mighty and a bit too worthy. I don't quite mean that, but there is a different attitude in Spain,
different culture,
and in Italy, and you know, in France, Richard Virenque is incredibly popular with the man in the street, and has been all but rehabilitated. You know, each case is kind of different.
If it's also a different awareness of the culture of the sport as well. I mean, a couple of tweets from Dan Lloyd, which I thought were very good on this. I think this is Dan Lloyd speaking. I think Valverde was dirty in the past. I think he's likely clean now. I don't know if that's true or false. Neither do you. We can only base our opinions on what we've read, heard, seen. I also think that if he was 15 years younger, he'd probably never have doped. And if some current clean riders were 15 years older, they may well have done. And I think that, you know, as I said on Friday, I think we're all products of our environment, our culture. And that is true. I think Valverde... The idealist in me thinks that Valverde and his doping that led to him being implicated in Operation Puerto was because he was part of a particular culture, and that he now operates in what we like to think is a very different culture. And David Miller made the point in his piece that as a rider who served a doping ban, Valverde is likely or certainly should be target tested a lot and tested more than other riders, and treated with a greater deal of suspicion and scepticism by the anti-doping authorities. That's certainly what should happen, what we hope happens. And given that, that's not evidence that he's clean. But I certainly think it's very possible that since he came back and has had to perform and operate in a different culture, a different environment, I think it's possible that he is clean. And therefore, he has this doping baggage, but I don't think it necessarily follows that he wins the world title as a result of doping.
When people talk about the reaction of Valverde's peers, I think there are two things that come into play there. I mean, there's no great outcry about Valverde winning the world championship or Valverde receiving the adulation and the plaudits that he does from his fellow pros. One, I think, because I think we often underestimate how much of the, you can call it, in the past it was maybe a code of silence, but like a solidarity, a comradeship between the riders, I think we underestimate how much of that is based on just a simple acknowledgement of what a hard job it is, and a mutual respect they have for guys who go out every day and hurt themselves in training as well as racing. And I think to have the career that Valverde's had, you have to do that. And they know, they talk amongst themselves, and everyone knows that Valverde is, from that point of view, a model pro. The other thing is that Valverde is a very personable guy, and I've seen him on numerous occasions, even in the last 12 months, you know, riding to the start in the morning, and there'll be a rider of no great reputation or palmarès who was, for example, in a break the previous day, and you'll see Valverde give him a pat on the back, and they've probably never spoken before. And, you know, small things like that, they make a difference. I think most of us base our opinions of people on, if we have had face-to-face interaction with them, that's the main thing that we base our opinions on. And for a lot of the riders, their experience of Valverde has been good. I mean, I'd be curious to hear what Michael Woods has to say now. Michael Woods finished on the podium in Innsbruck, but in the book that we did last year, Michael Woods was very outspoken about the Spanish generation of riders, the Contadors and the Valverdes. And I think, you know, his statement was something to the effect of, I wish they would just disappear now, those guys. I did notice some of the interaction between Woods and Valverde on the podium in Innsbruck, and it didn't seem to... his body language seemed to have changed slightly towards Valverde.
But again, it goes back to the point you just made. I mean, we're all human beings, aren't we? And we do...
Well, exactly. And Michael Woods, a year ago, or when he made those comments to us, he'd been in the World Tour peloton for just over a year, I think. And it's quite probable that by virtue of, well, through riding and competing against Valverde in the last year or so that he's developed a slightly different view of Valverde than he had a year ago.
It's a
three-dimensional one, not a two-dimensional one.
The greater the distance from anybody, the easier it is to have a very strong opinion about them. And we see this on social media.
Yeah, I mean, without being flippant and not comparing being a career conservative politician with being a former doper in cycling at all, lawyers, if you're listening. But I met my Tory MP on Friday and was all geared up to oppose almost everything he stood for and said, and found actually this is a person, a human being.
Oh, Lionel, he's becoming a father.
Yeah, I'd like,
I don't like the new Lionel.
I want to pull the
bring back the old Lionel.
Yeah, I want to pull the drawbridge up after me and my daughter, if that's possible. Yeah, everyone else can fend for themselves. That's the new world view. No, seriously, that's not true. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and it would be interesting to ask Michael Woods, you know, what his view on Valverde is, seeing as he didn't deny him a win because Woods finished third, but the coming together in that group, I wonder what was going through his mind, whether it even crossed his mind what his personal opinions were about the riders he was with.
And this applies an awful lot as well to riders of the younger generation, so 23, 24, 25 year olds. Often they're put on the spot and they're asked to almost denounce their predecessors, whether those predecessors still be riders in the peloton or their direct sportifs. And often they don't, simply because they've got to know those people. In some cases, they know their stories, they know what happened, why it happened, and also because they appreciate them as people.
I also think it's far too easy to kind of say, oh, there's an omerta in the peloton. There's a solidarity above everything in the peloton. There's a society in the peloton. Your safety depends on the guy in front of you and to the side of you and behind you. If somebody just taps on the brakes just to let you go through so you don't crash, you know, that they look after each other in a very physical, in a very visceral sense. They are all on the same side in that sense. Their safety is reliant on their colleagues. And so, you know, there is a kind of an understanding. And I mean, I'm sure that plenty of guys hate each other's guts, but when it comes down to it, you know, almost no one would do something to jeopardize the safety of another rider.
More importantly, what do we think of Valverde's rainbow jersey? Relief to see him go to, you know, black, the classic black shorts. It's quite vivid colors, quite bright colours, slightly different tones to the.
We're going
to
spend 5 minutes now discussing how vivid colours are. Rainbow jersey, but better than that. I would say, Rich, that I thought the World Championship Road Race was fantastic. Mm. I saw some people air misgivings about it having been too hard. I just don't see how you can argue that when we've seen so many World Championships over the last 15, 20 years where we have seen almost nothing until the last 15 minutes, which have been. This is the showcase for the UCI. I mean, this is pretty much the only race of any note in professional road cycling that is the UCI's own thing. And I think it's done a poor job of showcasing the sport in previous years. This race, from 50 kilometres to go, every protagonist, whether it be a guy who was pulling on the front or a guy getting dropped at the back, was a big name and was someone that people watching would have recognised. And it was well over an hour of really good entertainment. And I think, unfortunately, for the sprinters and for the classics riders, I think the UCI would have watched that and thought, you know, that's probably... Well, we can't afford to let another 10 years go by without a hilly, very difficult World Championship like this one. And in fact, we are going to see some hilly ones because I think in a couple of years in Martigny, it's going to be tough. I think maybe even Yorkshire next year will end up being quite tough.
But do you not think this is again an example of a race organiser, in this case the UCI, trying to tap into the trends that people enjoy, you know, things that are popular? I mean, whether or not you think it reduces it to a bit of a circus, seeing Tom Dumoulin weaving up the very, very steep 28%, I mean,
that'll be me tomorrow.
Well, on the 10%, that'll be you tomorrow. but this, I mean, I was watching that thinking, well, that tells me how hard this is. At the end of 250-odd kilometres, there was no hiding place. And yet, even though it was incredibly hard, there was still room for a little bit of tactical nuance. And the people that hesitated lost out again.
I mean, Valverde rode a brilliant race.
But, I mean, I think a lot of the teams rode brilliant races. I thought the Italians rode a really good race. Mm. And the French rode a fabulous race. Mm. Their finisher, Julian Alaphilippe, just wasn't on a particularly good day. But I also loved the slightly different configuration of the route, that there was this big reveal on the last lap of the the Gramont Bowden climb, because one of the things that makes the World Championship, or has made it fascinating, but also a little bit difficult to read, and sometimes a bit of an anticlimax, has been the repetition of the same lap again and again and again. Whereas this time, you didn't quite know what was coming, and you had. We also, you know, we'd seen social media videos and we'd seen photos of the final climb, but we were all desperate. We couldn't wait to see this final climb.
It was a great twist, wasn't it, to the plot, I suppose.
But gravel in the World Championships in 5 years' time, maybe, or something like that. I mean, why not?
In getting bogged down in the discussion about Valverde and his baggage, I don't think anybody's really focused that much on the brilliance of his ride, because he had come out of the Vuelta, we thought, you know, on his knees, really. Mm. And he can obviously, he's won on the Mur de Huy so many times, we know he can get up these steep climbs, but to get up with those two guys, real specialists on that sort of climb, Bardet and Woods, and to not, you know, put his nose in front until he absolutely had to take it on in the way that he did in the final kilometers as well. There was no kind of messing about. He knew exactly what he had to do and let it out, really, for the final kilometer. And I thought he rode a really good race.
Yeah, the other two had him exactly where they wanted him, and yet Valverde still managed to finish it off.
Did he? No doubt about what he was.
And he went early in the actual sprint as well. I mean, that was a kind of cold bloodedness. I mean, really, when you think about it, it's kind of daft after the event. Why didn't we have Valverde pegged as the absolute obvious winner? I mean, it's pretty much
on his knees. I guess so.
It struck me that Woods and Bardet, I mean, I don't know how realistic this was with such a fast descent, and was it 3 kilometers to the finish from the bottom of the descent? But the one way they could have potentially beaten him was to come to an agreement between themselves. You know, they wouldn't chase each other, and that way they probably would have given themselves a 35% chance each of winning. Valverde might still have been able to mark the moves and countered and gone away on his own, but with stone cold hindsight, you could say that by riding to the finish with him, they were condemning themselves to lose.
But the fascinating thing tactically about it from the top of the climb was the fact that Dumoulin was coming up, and they couldn't be certain whether he was going to make it. Also, Moscon, they would have known, well, he might come across as well. And you can't underestimate the fact that there's 3 prizes on offer. Okay, silver and bronze are not what they're all going for, but it can't... You if you're in the position where you could get a medal, that's going to cloud your thinking a little bit. It's not an all or nothing rainbow jersey or bust in the sense that, say, Liège-Bastogne-Liège or one of the other monuments is. That's a real prize for somebody. Yeah. And so with Dumoulin coming up,
you can't overestimate.
You've just got to think, well, there is something if I'm committed here, and so there wasn't that kind of incentive to say, well, win or bust. I don't care.
That was one difference here, Lionel. Was you mentioned them that the Dumoulin, the spectre of Dumoulin looming? But one thing that people haven't really discussed that much is the effect that the lack of radios possibly had on the finale, and that's something that, you know, it's particularly in one-day races, maybe, that we talk about evolution, different courses, but that's going to be a subject, I think, for another few years yet. And it's something that maybe the UCI will want to look harder at.
I think it's, again, an example that, you know, the prize is big enough that, no riders are saying, oh, this is terrible, we should have radios here at the World Championships. There's no kind of protest about it. They kind of just get on with it, accept that's the rule. And I think that is that because of the stature of the event. I mean, you could introduce any kind of rule. There was no real protest when they cut the team sizes down, where a few years ago you'd have the defending champions might have like 13 riders if it was Italy in the race. And so it has evolved because the prize is so valued and so cherished. But it's a good point. But it is a bit too easy to say the race was great because there weren't radios. I think, you know, that's probably sort of 20-25% of the reason.
The cycling podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for supporting Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. I'll be loading up with Science and Sport products tomorrow. I suspect that will not be enough. So, but and that's not to, you know, I'll still be a good advert for them, because I might get to 70 miles instead of say 40.
I can't wait to hear about this.
Gels and bars and so on.
Are you going to make a separate episode about your ride tomorrow?
No. Okay. There'll be no recording equipment allowed anywhere near it. Anyway, I'm really looking forward to it, as you can tell. We've got a long interview with Peter Sagan to play in a moment, but before we do, and he talks a bit about his relationship with Mark Cavendish in this interview. A bit of Mark Cavendish news, maybe, Daniel?
Well, we're awaiting an announcement from Mark Cavendish, but we think there's been a bit of a shock turn of events, namely that he is going to renew his contract with Dimension Data. A few weeks ago, I think Ivan said on the podcast that there was no chance of that happening, but, you know, we've never pretended that we get everything right here on the Cycling Podcast. But at that point, it did seem inconceivable, Rich, because I don't think it's any secret that the relationship between Doug Ryder, who is the team principal at Dimension Data, and Mark Cavendish wasn't great at the end of the Tour de France. Cavendish was unhappy with various things. After that, subsequent to that, we found out that Mark Cavendish was still suffering with the Epstein-Barr virus, which he'd already suffered from in 2017. And there were a couple of other options, it seemed like, on the table. There was talk of a deal with Bahrain Merida, that Cavendish was going to come on board with McLaren. I don't really know what kind of entity McLaren is beyond being a Formula One team. Aerodynamicists?
No, are they not aerodynamicists and experts in all of that kind of thing? No.
Yeah.
Product development.
Toothpaste.
But do they have any? I mean, how else do they? I mean, how do they make money?
That's a good question. They make cars, don't they? I mean, they make cars that they sell as well. McLaren cars, racing cars. I mean,
this is clearly not
civilian
our,
cars.
This is clearly not maybe our strong point in this
maybe
area.
We'll take this
anyway,
out.
It seems as though that deal, there were too many obstacles to that deal happening, not least the fact that Cavendish comes with a sizable entourage. Bernie Eisel, Mark Renshaw, Rolf Aldag, who's in the management and Dimension Data. That was one of the obstacles. There were others. And so from almost a practical point of view, the thing that always was going to make most sense was for him to stay at Dimension Data. He has always had an excellent relationship with the sponsor, Dimension Data, the company itself. And I think that was probably decisive in the end. Obviously, he's got his health issues to sort out over the next couple of months. He's been in the gym a lot in the last month or so. He can't do a lot of aerobic exercise, but he's certainly very, very motivated to get healthy again and to prove a lot of people wrong who've been writing him off. He certainly believes that there's life in the old dog yet, and that he can compete at the very highest level in sprints in the Tour de France and in other major tours.
McLaren do sell sports cars. They start at £250,000 and go up to just over £1 million, I believe. Mm-hmm. So
I'm in the market for a new car at the moment. Can you fit a child seat in one?
Not sure. We'll look into that line. Shall we hear from Peter Sagan?
Yes.
The former world champion. I met him in Seoul last week. His new book is out.
We just said no.
Well, then we'd have a problem. Yeah, Peter Sagan's new book, My World, is just out. So he was doing a round of interviews. He'd just been on the Chris Evans show on Radio 2 when I met him. He was quite surprised at how short it had been and that he hadn't been asked about his book.
Had he been asked about the intricacies of tactics and that kind of thing on BBC Radio 2?
Not really.
Ah.
No. So I tried to ask him about things like that and other stuff. And here he is, Peter Sagan.
It was really hard. Disappointing? Not, because I expect that it's going to be a really hard race. And, every year is different. And this year they made parkour for climbers. Then it's also good. And I'm happy that Valverde won, because it's going to be good holder of a rainbow jersey.
Will it be strange for you to see somebody else wearing the rainbow jersey?
No, why? It's
it must feel like your own.
I know. We have to change, right? Like every story has some the end, and maybe I can take it again next year.
Was it important to you that somebody like Valverde, with his pedigree and his record, wore the rainbow jersey after you?
Yeah, I think it's good that he won this race, and I think it's going to be also good for cycling, and for sure he had long story to take this jersey. Then he can be proud, and for sure he was waiting a lot for that.
There were some people, although the course did look like it was a climber's course, there were people who thought, you know, that you might still be there, because we've seen you before defy the odds and be there, you know, Tour California, and you know, you can climb, you've just ridden the Vuelta. Was there in the back of your mind even the smallest possibility that you might be able to win it?
Yeah, everybody get used for that I going to win, and it's easy, and the cycling is easy for me, and stuff like that. But it's different if you have to fight for victory in the stage races, and you know, you are going to make 150 kilometers or 180, and you have two climbs. Then I can maybe survive in some kind of climbs. But this was parkour only up and down, and after 6 hours, you know, all the climbs, what you did before, you feel it in the legs, and if it's just, when it's too much, then I explode also. Like climbing against climbers, then they have 65 kilos or 60, and I have 80. It is physically, it's almost impossible to repeat a lot of climbs with them.
But we read in your book about how Bergen last year, you know, you were ill, you were in bed, sick before the race.
Yeah.
And so you've surprised even yourself before, haven't you?
Oh yeah, for sure. I surprising myself a lot of times on the bicycle.
Well, that's funny you should say that. Because you said that, you know, people think that maybe cycling is easy for you. I mean, I'm sure it's not easy, but is it easier than it is for some of your competitors? Because your consistency, the number of times that you're, you know, in the top 10 even of the Tour de France, you have a remarkable level of consistency. How do you explain that?
Oh, well, it's a characteristic, I think. Like I am not pure sprinter, I am not a climber, but you know, maybe with the characteristic what I have, I could survive some hills with climbers. Then it's more easy for me win sprint with them than against only the sprinters. Sometimes I do, yeah, a lot of times I do sprints, and a lot of times I'm second, third, fourth, fifth, because always somebody is faster. But well, sometimes I win also.
It strikes me that, you know, over the last 10 years, certainly, that the guys at the very top have got more and more serious. They're spending more time at altitude and living a very extreme life, you know, where they're sleeping on top of a mountain and training really hard and not having time or space to do other things. Have you felt that too, that over the course of your career, it's got a bit more serious?
For sure, yes. Like cycling change the last 7-8 years, like cycling become more professional. Every cyclist starting to do more gymnastic, and you know, the work for the strength, and then you have to spend time in the gym, then on the bicycle, then you have to eat the right thing, and then they made much more races during the season. We are starting in Australia, what is in January, and we are racing until China, what is in November. And the season is much longer. And a lot of cycling starts to go for altitude, because you are producing more the red cells in your body than the oxygen. When you went down, you oxygen much better your muscles. Then that needs time. You have to be three 3 weeks at least in the altitude, then you are always out of home. Then depends from your schedule what kind of race you want to prepare. And my case, it's always classic Tour de France, and maybe the end is a world championship. Then it's another two and a half months spent in the altitude. And for me, from the start season, we are going to Sierra Nevada with the team, and there is tough. Like, we have everything. We have a nice centrum. You have gym, you have swimming pool, you can go sauna or jacuzzi, we have sauniers. But always in that period it's cold and we have to go down by car. It takes 1 hour. Then we training down, and if it's good weather, we climb back to Sierra Nevada. That's okay, but a lot of times we turning back by car. Then you wake up at 8 in the morning, then you go for the ride. Then you turn back in the hotel around 6 p.m. and it's already all day done. But after that is hard period, like training camp in Sierra Nevada. But after that, when I'm going for California, I prefer to go in Utah for altitude, because you have more fun there and more entertainment in the in the city. You can go
Is it Park City you go to?
Yeah.
Do you have you own a place in Park City, do you?
No, I always renting the house.
Yeah. Oh, I heard when I was there a couple of years ago, they told me that you had a place there with your brother, but you don't have a place.
No, no. I heard also a lot of people talking about I bought a house there, but no.
You know, you seem to like America a lot. Obviously, you ride the tour of California regularly, and you spend a lot of time there. Is America somewhere that you maybe would like to live in the future?
Well, living in future, I think a lot of times we have no choices. Depends where you have to work, depends what you want to do. But if I have some choice in the future, then I can do something in America, I say why not.
What's it like for you now to go back home to Slovakia? You know what, because I've read about how famous you are there. You know, when you win, it's the first item on the news and front page of the newspapers. Yeah. So everybody must know you there. What does it feel like to go home?
I don't turn back often to Slovakia. Maybe I'm going to visit family for Christmas, or if I have something to do in Slovakia, then I spend maybe 2-3 days there. This year I spent maybe 3 days in Slovakia, not too much. Then I turn back for a national championship, and that is also before after Tour of Swiss. Then I go there for 3 days and I'm going for national championships, and after Tour de France is starting, then it's not too much time. But I prefer if somebody from family can come to me in Monaco, it's much better. We can enjoy life more. In Slovakia, it's almost impossible to go shopping, or you know.
Really? Is it like that?
Yeah, like I think everybody knows me there. And if I go for a gas station in my car, then it's happened already twice. Then I forgot to pay because everybody just asked me something, and I just went for a toilet, and I turned back, and I didn't pay. Yeah, funny story. But after I turned back to pay,
good. I'm glad you cleared that up. Yeah. Tell me about the academy in Slovakia, though, the Peter Sagan Academy that you've set up.
Oh well, that is an old team. My hometown. I just said, okay, I grow up there, let's to help them some way. When I was starting there, we were only 15 riders, maybe, in different categories, from the kids until under 23. And now we are, or they have 80 kids. And they have under 23 team. It's already good, and the riders can have some chance to grow up there and maybe see, you know, the European races. And the last year we made Matusz Stoczek, then he signed contract in Italy team, and now he's living there. He's starting second year. Then it's nice to see then somebody can grow up and see also the European cycling.
Peter, do you remember that Tour Down Under? Because you were the youngest guy in the race. I remember the criterium where you got in the breakaway with Lance Armstrong, the oldest guy and the youngest guy. Yeah. I mean, what was that like for you? Did you, you know, because did somebody like that, did he mean anything to you? Were you daunted at all? Were you nervous? Or did you just look on it as a bike race and didn't really think about the guys?
Well, Australia that year, 2010, it was a very nice experience for me. Already criterium, I didn't know what to expect from the World Tour racer. And I was first time in World Tour. Then I just tried to enjoy it. And for sure, in my mind was I going to help the team, because I was very young. And in that time I was 19. I never thought about my results, then I going to win something, or it was more year by year. And like every young rider is thinking, I think more about to stay in the team. Like, I have my opportunity, I am here, and after you just want to show your team then you are good to help to somebody, or yeah, if it's possible to make some results. But I never thought about like going to do some sprint or some results, because I was very young. Like, it's more important rider in the team than me.
But it was very obvious that you were capable of riding and challenging for the win. You had the terrible crash on the stage, and do you remember I came and interviewed you in your room after that crash?
Yeah.
Do you remember we'd made an arrangement in the morning, and I was amazed that you still wanted to do the interview, because you were covered in bandages and...
Well, it was everything new for me. Then I was happy if somebody have some question for me, then let's go, no?
But what?
It was not no. That much like now.
Not like now, where you hate interviews, but the at the time, I don't know if you remember this, but the race was on television, and there was a moment where they showed the crash again, and, mm-hmm. and you kind of leapt forward on the bed, and you really wanted to watch it. You really wanted to see what had happened, which... I don't know, that struck me as strange that you wanted to, you almost enjoyed it, seemed looking at watching your crash. But do you watch back, I mean, not necessarily crashing, but do you watch a lot of bike racing? Do you watch a lot of the finishes that you've been involved with?
No, like, especially if I am in home and I have my free time, then it's no time to watch bike racing. I watch sometimes if I'm somewhere, then I see television, maybe in the bar or somewhere, then yes. Or
so you wouldn't have watched the Giro this year?
No, and I am in Truth, California. Yes. But after I'm in training camp, then I doing my job. I don't care about another race. I am not racing.
Who won the Giro?
Froome.
Just trying to catch
last
you
last year, Dumoulin.
Yeah.
And 3 years ago, I don't know.
I'll not test you too much. In the book that you say that you were, you know, you thought about retiring, just packing it in your first year with Tinkoff. Is that true?
Yeah. We were in Lake Tahoe together, and I had serious problem with my leg, and I was twisted on the bike and things. Then, I don't know how to say, I did a lot of second places that time, the last 2 years. And I was like, I don't know, like, I finished this contract with Tinkoff, and we will see. Like, I didn't even like to ride, because I always suffer on the bicycle and what to do. And that day we opened the wine bottle with the number one. And Lomba says that if I win this year World Championship, and I said, how is it possible I'm going to win World Championship? No, we are going to make you fix. That is important. We are going to find some physiotherapies or some coach for some exercise and things. Or if we have to do surgery, we are going to do surgery. And after you will see, you are going to feel again good. I say, yeah, blah, blah. Okay, let's go for a tour of California. And he said, if you're going to win a world championship, then I'm going on the bike with you and make the lap around Lake Tahoe. It's around 120 kilometers, and up and down. And Lomba, after when he stopped his career, he was never on the bicycle. And he stopped, and he never touched a bike. And I said, okay, let's do that. But it was bad, then it's never going to happen. And after Richmond, a year later, we did the lab around the Lake Tahoe, yeah.
Well, your body obviously was giving you problems. You were not getting the wins that you could have had, but also your relationship with Oleg Tinkoff didn't seem to be great. I mean, you describe in the book that he was both difficult and sort of not fun, but there was never a boring moment, it seems, with Tinkoff.
Oh, no. I had, from the start, I was in a new position because I changed team and I went to Tinkoff and I didn't know anybody from the team. And after starts crazy things with Bjarne and Oleg starts fired a few people from the team. And I said, this is crazy. And after my spring, what I did, and I'm not happy about the results, what you did. Always I have to think about my results. I am responsible for that. But I'm going to hold you in the team, but we have to reduce your salary and stuff like that. And it's wrote in the book, then I was not agree with that. Because we signed contract for 3 years, why he wants to change my contract after 3 months?
Did he just want to reduce your yeah. contract?
Yeah.
How did you feel about that?
No, I lost my trust in the team. Like, you're going to pay me 1 year and I'm going out from the team. And in September, I'm going to form new team and I'm going to ride for a different team. And after he think about that and after he said, no, I want to keep you. And I think he did very good because he catch green jersey, world champion title in Tinkoff. But I have to say about Oleg, by time when I know him better, because this was after 4 months, I didn't really know with who I'm dealing or what kind of person he is. But after we spent private time together and I did also good results for the team. Then I have to say he is businessman. I have to say he is good. Like, all the experience and the memories what I have from Tinkoff, it's only this one is a little bit strange, but in the end, I was also good there in Tinkoff, was a very good team. And with Oleg, I have still good contact, and he's good.
Tell me about the what you did after the Tour de France last year when you were disqualified from the race, sent home, and the holiday that you organized on the yacht.
tell us about that.
Oh, well, for sure it was a big surprise. Like, because I got ready for Tour de France, I did my best. Tour of California, then training camp, then Swiss National Championship, then we went for a tour and I was ready. I won one stage, and after fourth, fifth, or sixth stage, they just kicked me out. But, well, then I said, well, I'm going to spend the time in my head, and I'm going to think about to be in the race and what could I do, or I just going to enjoy my free time, finally. Then I have to take it like positive way, and I had good holiday with family.
So you went home, you went back to Monte Carlo, and very quickly, it seems, you organized the yacht.
Yeah,
how quickly was that?
One day.
For 28 people?
Because we went home with Gabriele and Giovanni in Monte Carlo. And we wake up in the morning and we went for breakfast. I just said, what we can do? Like, I'm going to organize yacht now. Then I call my friend, and I wanted to organize yacht just for us, and maybe for a wife, and then maybe for 9 people. And Gabriele going to call his wife. Giovanni has his wife with him, and that time I was also together, my wife. And I called to my friend and he told me, like, I have special offer for you. And I said, what kind of offer? Like, we have a big boat, like Cristinao, for a very good price for you, and it's much better than the small yacht. And I said, okay, and how many rooms is it? It's for 27 people or something like that. And I said, okay, let's do it. I'm going to call my family and everybody from Slovakia, friends. Then I make to come them from Slovakia. We organize flights for, I think, 12 people from Slovakia. And they then went in Monte Carlo the day after in the morning. And we just started our holiday trip for 4 days.
And you had an accident on the boat. You knocked your teeth out.
Yeah. Yeah.
We never knew about that, I don't think.
And nobody knows.
They do now.
Until tomorrow.
So you but that sound quite serious. Was alcohol involved? How did it happen?
Oh, well, always in holidays some alcohol, but it was more about accident than it's jacuzzi on the boat and the grill around jacuzzi, and I stepped on the grill fell inside and my leg just stuck in that hole. And after I just crashed on the top of the jacuzzi ding. Angle.
Ding. So those false teeth you've got there.
Are they?
They look very real.
now it's also sign on jacuzzi.
How do you get on with Mark Cavendish now? Because I know that you were friends, you made up, but how are relations with him now?
I made him also this year in Tour de France, but he's still angry on me. Yeah, but, well, I did everything. I didn't do that what's happened in purpose, but in the end, after all the analysis, then you can see that it was just accident. And also from his side, he went from the back. Then what I can do? I told him sorry, but if I fell also down, then what, it's gonna be better for him, like better feeling, or I don't know. I just try to survive and I stay on the bicycle, I finish the stage, and just happened what happened. And the life is continuing. For him, as I saw this year, then he's still angry, yeah.
So that was Peter Sagan. He said at the end there about his relationship with Mark Cavendish seems to have broken down. I was quite not surprised because we knew this, but there seemed to be quite a lot of sadness on his part at that he feels he's apologized and that he wasn't, that if he hadn't moved his elbow in the way that he did, that he would have come down too in that incident. But he didn't labour that point, and it seemed to me more a feeling of sadness that his relationship with Mark Cavendish has broken down. So there we are. Lots more of the thought that was quite interesting in there, especially the insight into the days that he spends up at altitude at Sierra Nevada, how long and grueling they are. So I hope you enjoyed that. That's all from us for this week. We'll be back next week. We've got an episode of the cycling podcast, Femina, has just come out this week. We had a couple of special episodes from the World Championships last week, Kilometre Zero episodes with Edvige Patel and Badreddin Wise, the Syrian refugee who was competing for Syria in Innsbruck. Really fascinating story. So those are both available now. We have got a couple of shows coming up. We should mention them briefly. Our show at Clapham, the Clapham Grand on November the 12th with Amara Terra. Tickets are paused at the moment. There should be a few more released in the next week or so.
Yeah.
Stay tuned for that. But we're just reconfiguring the venue a little bit because we sold out of tickets. But we should have a few more to sell in the next week or so. So we will make an announcement about that very soon. But really looking forward to that. We're expecting a full house and it should be a great, great atmosphere. A couple of weeks later, November the 27th, we're doing a show at St. David's Hall in Cardiff. A few tickets left for that
as well. Yeah, there's 50-ish left for Cardiff. Tickets are available, so not many. If you'd like to come along, snap them up before they all go.
TheCyclingPodcast.com, you'll find a tab there for live events. Go there and you can get tickets. But in the meantime...
I just wanted to mention, I know you've mentioned it in previous episodes, but friends of the podcast, we released Connor Dunn and Larry Warbass's episode, The No-Go Tour. Their team, Aqua Blue, were, well, it folded pretty much on the eve of the Tour of Britain and left them without pretty much the biggest race that they had planned for the season. And so instead they went on a cycling touring holiday in the Alps and in French Alps and into Italy. And they kept an audio diary for us, and it's a fantastic listen. Really kind of, it's a bit of an emotional roller coaster, but a very heartwarming story by two very good storytellers. I thought, I listened to it whilst sitting up in hospital with a very young baby a couple of weeks ago, and it kept me going that night. Certainly really entertaining listen. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com/friends.
Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.